On the Empire Podcast this week, we go toe-to-toe with the action titan that is the Raid 2's Gareth Evans. We ask the quiet one, Sam Claflin, to speak up a bit, and we tackle the brilliant Calvary. All that and much, much more on the movie podcast that lost all its money in the Grand National last week. But then when you bet on a horse because it's named after a rubbish Gene Hackman Tommy Lee Jones movie, frankly, you're asking for it. The package you let me down. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, back on Podding Duty, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, custom and a trifling HR policy designed to ensure I'm never in a room with fewer than four people after an incident that's been blown out of all proportion, quite frankly, dictates I'm joined by three colleagues. First up is our geek queen, a lady so immersed in the arcane arts of the nerdy that she can have a conversation with you about Captain America's helmet and Thor's massive hammer and keep a straight face throughout. It's Helen O'Hara.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean, Chris. I'm not sure anyone would giggle at either of those two expressions.
Next up is the irrepressible whippersnapper who edits a podcast and he's always moaning about the fact he never gets to do a set visit. Well, last week he broke his duck in spectacular style. Didn't you, Ali Plum? Tell the lovely people where you were.
I can't.
You can.
Am I allowed to?
A little bit.
I was told that I wasn't allowed to.
All right, don't then.
I won't then.
Excellent. And last but not least is a younger whippersnapper. He's making Ali look old, making his debut on the pod. It's our staff writer, Ben King Kirby. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I feel like I should be wearing a special hat or something.
You should be, yeah, or a special t-shirt.
Yeah, you've all got t-shirts.
Everyone here has a thing. So Phil has an art house thing. Helen's a geek. Ali edits things and moans about things. And does quizzes. What? Don't shake your head. What's your thing? Well, that I can exploit to comedic potential.
I mean, I help Ali edit podcasts sometimes and help him moan sometimes. And also, if you Google Ben Kirby, the first thing that comes up is a very good-looking man in his underwear, who isn't me, who is apparently an underwear model in America. And so everyone often mistakes me for a very handsome underwear model, understandably.
Gosh.
And I've had the occasional email.
You do sound like a very handsome underwear model.
You are wearing nothing but underwear right now.
Yeah, that was the way the t-shirt thing.
They're meant to go around your waist, though, not on your head.
Damn.
Are you talking to Ben or me?
Ben.
Oh, okay.
We've given up on you, Chris.
Yeah, I like to roam free. Okay, it's time now for your questions that you've been sending to us via Twitter and email all week. The first question is from someone who shall remain nameless and for reasons that will become obvious. He says, I'm going to be proposing to my girlfriend next week. Wish me luck. Good luck, nameless person. I was wondering what you consider to be the best movie proposals apart from the one in When Harry Met Sally. Interesting. Best movie proposals.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got really proposals so much as general declarations of love, but I think if you ever need to get romantic, you can do a lot worse than look to Cyrano de Bergerac. I would personally go for the Gerard Depardieu starring one of, 1991? Because the English translation by Anthony Burgess is also brilliant. The poetry there is absolutely fantastic. But really, it's just wildly romantic and utterly fantastic. So I would say go to that, take some inspiration, and, you know, you'll probably do well because you've got a smaller nose than him, probably.
Maybe not, though.
Well, I mean, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he might have a massive conch.
Pretty darn big to be bigger than Cyrano's.
This is very true. Very true. Ben?
I've got a soft spot for the proposal in Rocky 2, where Rocky proposes to Adrian in a zoo, and he uses a tiger as his backdrop. And it's one of the most awkward proposals I've ever seen in my life. I know that's kind of the point, because Rocky's not great with words, but at the same time, it's really quite awkward. He kind of, he asks her, she doesn't hear, and then he lifts up her earmuffs and then asks her again. She goes, oh, okay. And then they kiss, and then he invites the tiger to the wedding. So if he wants to take her to London Zoo and propose in front of the tigers, maybe that could be an idea.
Okay. Spider-Man 3 gets a lot of flack.
Yeah, it
but
does.
But there's a nice, funny little sequence. It actually doesn't end in a proposal, does it? But with Bruce Campbell and Tobey Maguire. Bruce Campbell as the horrible waiter who interferes with Tobey Maguire's attempts to propose to Mary Jane with the little ring in the glass and everything. Mm. And it's all very funny and amusing.
There's a similar scene to that in Everyone Says I Love You, the Woody Allen film, where Edward Norton's trying to propose and in a restaurant, and it all goes a bit pear-shaped with the ring. Don't put the ring in food, is what we're saying. That doesn't always end up well.
I've got another declaration of love rather than an actual out-and-out proposal. I would also say The Wedding Singer needs a mention, because that song is in my head most days.
Mm.
All I want to do is grow old with you.
Oh, not Somebody Kill Me Please.
No, that is in my head, but not as a song. Love Actually also probably, you know, it's got two or three or four or five, you know, Rick Grimes proposing to her off Pirates of the Caribbean with bits of card.
I hate that scene. I hate everything it stands for.
What does it stand for?
Adultery.
Yeah. It stands for Rick Grimes being a twat.
And a waste of cardboard.
Yeah.
And poor Chiwetel as well. Sitting there not knowing anything about it, watching telly. He doesn't know.
What is going on? It's ridiculous.
Anyway.
Yeah, sorry.
So I want to mention The Fisher King. And there's a really, really wonderful, sweet, romantic, lovely moment that I, for whatever reason, didn't make it into our 25 most romantic moments of our lifetime feature, which you can check out online, as well as obviously in the mag from a couple of months ago, February. Imagine that. Where Robin Williams Parry, who is actually quite unwell man, but a very sweet man who's suffered a lot. He's wearing a white, big white, too big for him suit with black pinstripes. And he's speaking to Lydia, who is Amanda Plummer, who is a kind of a lost soul in the city of New York. And it includes, he essentially just says to her, they're walking down the street after a really lovely date. And she goes, well, I know what's going to happen next. You're going to want to go up to my apartment and then we'll probably have a coffee, but you don't drink coffee, so we'll probably have a drink. And then after we have a drink and get to know each other, we might sleep with each other. And then we wake up in the morning and then I'll get your number and you'll get my number. And then, you know, I'll feel great for an hour, but then you won't call me as much as I'd like you to. And then I feel like it isn't working out. And then, okay, I'm leaving. Bye. So she runs off and then he chases after her and essentially says, well, to be honest with you, I know this is odd, but I've been loving you from afar for years, and here's why. And he uses lines such as, I have a hard-on for you the size of Florida, which is just so romantic.
Wow.
And I know out of context that sounds horrible, but
it's
done with that big, you know, Robin Williams beardy grin. Mm. And it's also got, you know, this line, which I wish I could use more, but I think you're the greatest thing since Spice Racks. You know, this is the mid-90s, early 90s, 1991 this was. So, you know, Spice Racks were really cool then. But yeah, it's great. I honestly love it. You should so check it out if you haven't seen The Fisher King already. It got Robin Williams an Oscar nomination, and Mercedes Ruhl actually won for Best Supporting Actress, who isn't in this scene, but, you know.
I'll tell you what else is awesome. It's not so much a proposal, but the kiss montage from the end of Cinema Paradiso, that would be a good backdrop to any kind of romantic gesture or proposal. And of course, we haven't mentioned, you know, the likes of Gone with the Wind, which is all swoony and lovely and beautifully dressed. And that's got quite a good declaration of love in it as well.
There's a really interesting one in Romero's Dawn of the Dead, where Stephen, played by David Emge, proposes to Galen Ross's Fran. And it's really weird and horrible and bleak because it means nothing. And he's desperately trying to cling on to some semblance of normality, some semblance of society, and it's horrible. It's it's making me shiver quite thinking about it right now. But yes,
nice tip for
don't do that. Yeah, don't do that. Person who should remain nameless. Don't trigger a zombie apocalypse and then propose to your lady in the aftermath of all that.
Wise words for all of us there.
To be fair, he could take a leaf out of Rick Grimes' book, you know, if that were the case.
You could. Everything comes back to Rick Grimes. All right, let's move on to the next question. This is from @OB08 via Twitter. If you could get the original cast members back to do one more Carry On, what genre or historical event would you like to see lampooned?
I would like the NSA, recent NSA problems, the phone hacking and all that kind of stuff, be remade as Carry On Up the Cyber.
Oh!
I honestly have nothing for this question.
That's good.
That was pretty good.
You could do a superhero film with Carry On cast, Carry On caping. Sid James was Superman, though, that'd be dangerous with his X-ray vision. I'm not sure that should happen.
I'd love to see that. Sid James is Sidney Wayne. a billionaire playboy. You know, Kenneth Williams would be an amazing Joker.
That's true. He has the nostrils for it.
How could you not see that? Absolutely. That would be amazing. Can someone work on resurrecting the Carry On cast and making this happen? Bernard Breslau as the Penguin. It's all fitting into place.
Barbara Windsor as Harley Quinn.
Oh, my God.
This is going to be awesome.
And then Hattie Jakes as Catwoman, obviously.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Ooh, meow.
Scientists, get on this. Make this happen.
If you're not too busy curing cancer, if you could just investigate resurrecting people.
Yeah. I mean, bring them back as they were, not as they are now. Although that would be Carry On the Walking Dead.
Yeah, because again, we've discussed not triggering a zombie apocalypse.
Don't trigger a zombie apocalypse.
It's not the way to declare your life.
Wah, 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 munch some brains, etc. So that's it. That's it. That's the best movie ever made, isn't it? Right there, right there.
What, Carry On zombies?
Yeah, no, Carry On caping. It's amazing. Oh, okay. Next question is from @NCLow, regular contributor to the podcast. What's your guilty pleasure TV? I'm addicted. She's saying this. I'm addicted to Police Interceptors, UK Border Force, and Bar Rescue. I don't know any of those programs.
Is UK Border Force a program? I thought it was
I think it is actually literally about the UK border services.
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Well, smuggling and all sorts, but amazing. Not in a cool Han Solo way, in a really amazing. Kind of nerdy way.
Don't tell the bride. That's obviously, we all love that. Obviously.
Obviously.
Come on.
Obvs.
And MasterChef doesn't count.
MasterChef does count.
And I don't think that Great British Bake Off counts either, or the Great British Sewing Bee.
What about the Great British Menu?
No, I don't think that does either. It ends in a really posh, like, it's okay. It's got too high. The production values are too high. It's got to be a little bit shonk. And this is where my one, I think, if you haven't seen it, you have to watch it. It's called Sport Relief's Top Dog, presented by Gabby Logan. And it's got a series of really lovable, wonderful C, D, E, F, G, you'll run out of notes list celebrities who come along with their dogs and do tricks with them and try and, you know, catch a ball a certain number of times or whatever for Sport Relief and to, you know, make money for charity. So it is a good thing, totally. But it's just obviously made for the price of a pack of peanuts. It is so cheap. You can see the backboard just wobbling as they're talking. But to see Ainsley Harriott, you know, fart about throwing a ball at a bunch of fake coconuts is amazing. Also, Sally Gunnell, Caprice, Danny Baker, they're all there.
These are strange names for dogs.
Yeah, true. And one DJ who I don't know, but it works at the BBC somewhere, he's called OJ, and he had a dog called Lebowski. And I really liked
obviously
that there was a dog called Lebowski.
Someone in this day and age is called OJ.
Mm.
I mean, it could be OJ.
It could be OJ.
It's not OJ.
It's not. We've checked.
It's a different person.
That's a strange nickname to take.
Well, maybe his first, you know, his initials are O and J.
Maybe he really enjoys orange juice.
Show me the bone, Lebowski, or show me the ball, Lebowski. Appeal to me. So that's my crap TV love. It should be on iPlayer.
Amazing. Helen, it strikes me that you like long walks in the park, theatre, yeah. Culture.
Uh-huh. Culture, yeah.
It doesn't strike me that you would be watching the Jeremy Kyle show or equivalent.
No. I do watch, my kind of brainless TV is probably the Food Network. Mm-hmm. I sort of sit there watching food porn, essentially, and drooling like Homer over a donut. My particular favourite is Barefoot Contessa with Ina Garten. But I'm not sure that's really guilty pleasure, because she appeared in an episode of 30 Rock, which I'm pretty sure makes her pretty cool.
If you haven't heard the Josh Brolin interview from a couple of weeks ago, he lists his top six favourite, like, Food Channel TV shows. Mm. And he's not as big a fan of Man vs. Food as I am, but
oh my God.
He loves stuff. So if you haven't listened to it already, go back and listen to it.
Definitely. Also that they have a show called Cupcake Wars on the Food Network.
Sounds good.
Where you literally competitively make cupcakes. Oh, it's so exciting.
Sounds real good. Yeah, Man vs. Food's amazing. I love Adam Richman. I wish one day he would appear in this podcast with a massive pork loin. And we could talk to him. That would be astonishing.
Hopefully he'd be wearing pants over his pork loin.
Does an entire channel count as guilty pleasure?
What, BBC Two?
No, Sky Sports News.
Yeah.
That's my thing.
I was going to say BBC Three, but it's getting cancelled soon. But that's got Snob Mary Avoid.
No, it's not getting cancelled. It's going to the iPlayer.
That's true.
It'll be available to all. Yeah, Sky Sports News for me. I love Wanted Down Under. Does anyone know this programme? It's a TV programme that follows families from Britain who wanted to emigrate to Australia or New Zealand. So Nicky Clark, formerly of Pop Idol, is the host of this, and she goes with them basically to get a week's jolly to Australia or New Zealand, and they look around three houses that, you know, they probably can't afford, and they talk to someone about their lifestyle, and it's great. It's rubbish, but it's great, because, you know, you're just kind of going, oh, I'd quite like to do that, that'd be alright, go down, edit Empire Australia, that'd be alright.
So is this like Escape to the Country, except Escape to another country?
Yes, it's like location, 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 but it's like relocation, mate, you know, it's like that.
Right. In fact, there is an Australian edition of Location, 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 where Phil, because he lives half the year apparently with his wife in Australia,
he takes
them down to Australia, and I think he's just there because he lives there anyway, so it's easy for him. And they take them around houses, and it's mostly good to watch just because the houses are so cheap compared to London that you just get really sad because they've got amazing views, amazing weather, and they're about half the price.
My God.
I would just like to say hello to all the people who occasionally tweet at me from Canada, America. I hope you're enjoying this. I hope this means anything to you.
Listen, hey, if I'm transatlantic here. Yeah. The Food Network is international. It speaks to all of us.
If people can download American TV in this country, they can make an effort and watch Wanted Down Under or Sky Sports News. Admittedly, you have to download 24 hours of TV. It's a bit difficult to catch up, but honestly, it's amazing. Did you know, and I'm giving this away a little bit, this is going to be in the next issue of Empire, the 300th issue of Empire. Did you know that James Bobin, the director of Muppets and Muppets Most Wanted, his dad is an anchor on Sky Sports News, David Bobin. Did you know that?
I didn't, but I'll be honest, my levels of caring kind of gave out there halfway through your statement.
Mine gave out after you said the statement.
Ben? I'm interested still. Carry on.
Good. Well, I have no more. That's it.
Oh.
That's it. Thanks for your questions. If you have any more for us, do send them in. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. You can use the hashtag EmpirePodcast or JanSorry1Suit. You can email us podcast@EmpireOnline.com or you can Facebook us. No one ever Facebooks us. Just complaints and stuff. It's just, you know, it's like nude pictures.
Look, thank you for the people who do.
But thank you, obviously. Yeah. But, you know, and the nude pictures are great.
Mm.
Love the nude pictures. But more questions, please. Right. Okay, time now for our first interview. Norwich City's loss is cinema's gain. Sam Claflin could have become a professional footballer with his hometown team, but opted for the bright lights of movie sets instead of the turgid grind of a relegation battle. Smart move. After gracing blockbusters like Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides and The Hunger Games 2, or The Hunger Games Catching Fire, this is more accurately known. Helen staring at me there going, get it right. He stars this week's Hammer Horror, The Quiet Ones. He popped in recently to talk to Helen and Phil. I knew that. Enjoy.
I think somebody did this tweet yesterday. Sam Neill. Apparently Stephen Fry got him into Norwich.
What?
Yeah, so Sam Neill's the latest.
The Norwich? He came to Norwich? Sam Neill was in Norwich?
I don't know if he came to Norwich, but Stephen Fry's introduced him to the concept of Norwich City.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. That's really exciting. Our new Delia Smith.
Your new Delia.
It's the man from Jurassic Park. That's fucking genius. That is great.
There you go. Do you need a new Delia? You've still got the old Delia.
I'd like, you know, I want her to find love now, you know. And I want to set her up with Jurassic Park. Alan. Is it Alan? I can't remember.
I think it's Alan Grant.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
With Alan.
Well done, us.
Yes.
So somebody was literally making, like, Scooby-Doo noises.
There was a moment in the film where, you know, there are some noises off screen, and so we'd all react at the same time and, you know, do our stupid, ugly, scared faces at the same time. He decided he was going to vocalize said furniture moving. So you'd get this scrape, screech, bang. And there was also a moment where someone had to walk down the stairs. I think that was when that was the final straw, I think, because we're all laughing so hard. It was like he wasn't watching the monitors. He was so invested in his little part in the film. He was like, okay, and action, scrape, you know, totally into it. But anyways, he was then trying to imitate someone walking down the stairs. There were stairs in the house, as you can imagine, but he tried to go, and step, 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 stairs, and creaky stair, and clap, clap, bang. You know, we're like, why don't we just have somebody walk down the stairs, jump on a few stairs when you need the bangs? And they were creaky stairs. Anyway.
Did he go properly method? Did he sort of disappear to IKEA for the weekend?
Tried on a few different stairs.
See how the stairs and the furniture moved.
I wouldn't be surprised, actually.
That sounds like the most unusual class at Lambda ever.
No, at Lambda we had our moments. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there were definitely moments. I remember being at drama school and it was like one of my first weeks and there was a movement class and we were told to pick a sonnet from Shakespeare, pick two words out of any given sonnet. I chose angel and death. That I thought were very contrasting. I thought, great. She was like, okay, now we're going to physicalize these words. I was like, cool, man. This is, you know, you're really, really into it. You believe everything you hear. And trust me, I learned a hell of a lot. But I just remember being lied out on the floor with my eyes closed, as with everyone else in the class. And, you know, you start moving through your toes before you sort of say the word out loud. You start moving through your toes and you take that word through to your kneecap and through to your fingertips and through your shoulders and your head. Now you can stand up, get on your knees, stand up, and now physicalize it in your whole body. You know, angel in my head. And she says, now start vocalizing, you know, but as an angel would. So, yeah, angel. And then next to me was my big New Zealand, like, rugby player built mate who was going, power, and I was right next to him going, angel, and I opened my eyes and just went, what the hell am I doing right now? Like, it's the most, I was like, this must be candid camera somewhere. Someone must be filming this. Like, what am I doing?
If somebody did film those drama lessons and then waited for you all to get famous, do you know what I mean? I think you'd
make a buck or two. And maybe really that's what's going to happen in a few years. If I ever became famous, it's something that's going to creep out of the woodwork. But yeah, it was tough. There were definitely moments, or, you know, animal studies, which again is some people find hugely like sort of inspiring, you know, to find a character, you sort of find an animal that you think that character is like. But there were just, I picked a turtle for the fact that it was the easiest. I thought, well, I'm just going to be in my shell for a little while. And occasionally I'd pop my head out and move very softly. But then you had like people being llamas. You got to choose which animal you wanted to portray. I was like, why are you picking a difficult zebra? Like, what makes a zebra different from a horse, you know?
Yeah, like, you thought like a mountain goat would be a high risk option.
It's exactly right.
So you were somebody that had limited mobility.
Exactly. I could do it in a very slow manner. I could just look at the floor, didn't have to look up. You know, so if I laughed at other people, you know, it's fine.
We had Imogen Poots on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she was telling us about one of her very unusual auditions. I think she was about 16 or 17 at a drama school, and she had to act like she was in labour for this project. I can't remember if she got it or not. What's been the weirdest audition that you've had in your career so far?
I've actually been quite lucky. I mean, I've heard some horror stories, but I think the worst I've done was at the time it was for a project called Birdsong, which later became a TV miniseries, but I auditioned for the film like in my third year of drama school. It was for a part that had two lines, very small part. I was like, really happy for like an audition. And the two lines were over 7 pages. So I had to, in the audition, I wasn't entirely sure where the second line was. I knew, you know, I got given the script on the day and sort of found the one line. And I remember it was Crawling Through Mine. Unfortunately, I wasn't even a bird. No, it wasn't that good. It was a guy who said no on one page, and then like 7 pages later went they were my two lines. So I sort of was sat at a table in this audition room with about 11 producers, directors, and all sort of like casting directors. Started crawling on the table. I started going, no! Wait a sec. Turn the page. Nothing. Turn the page. Nothing. Turn the page. It went on and on. And eventually, 7th page. All right. Going to give him a cue. Yeah. It's like, come on. What can you do with that? Like, there's sat at a table trying to portray a person crawling through a mine. I mean, it was tough. But I've also heard Matthew McFadden told me this incredible story of this audition that he'd done once. I think this he did it about him auditioning to be a like paratrooper in a film, or the character was like man whose parachute doesn't open. That was like the official title of this character. No lines. They got him to mimic falling out of a plane or jumping out of a plane whose parachute doesn't open. That was all the character was. Apparently, he auditioned for it, did the stepping up to the plate or the stepping up to the edge of the door, jumping. But stood still. I mean, what can you do? So he's just stood still, waiting, kind of looking down below, pulls a chute, you know, starts looking around and nothing's... I mean, there's nothing... what can you... There's nothing you could do in a moment like that. It's a nightmare.
It's a Hamlet ad, isn't it? You just light your cigar. Get the music playing.
Oh, this is my death. This is the last minute.
Yeah. I wanted to... You mentioned Matthew McFadden, who you played a younger version of.
Yes.
In Any Human Heart, which is a lovely book and a great adaptation as well. And Sam Claflin becomes Matthew McFadden, who becomes Jim Broadbent. I wondered, have you seen a picture of a young Jim Broadbent? Do you know what he looks like?
Do you know what's incredible? Yes, I have.
Do you have any resemblance at all?
No. You know, in a good way for him, I'm pretty sure. But like, it was... What's so funny is I used to be a caretaker at Lambda when I was, you know, to pay for myself to live in London, basically. So like at the weekends and every evening after drama school, I'd go and lock the drama school, set the alarms and blah, 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 do a lot of the cleaning up. And they asked me one day to kind of clean out these barrels that had all this sort of archived sort of information and audition notes from, like, I mean, years ago, like to the 1920s, kind of that long ago. So, I mean, there are so many famous people you kind of come across and you read their notes from the teachers, like what they wrote in their audition. I mean, it was the most incredibly like informative, and me and my friends took loads of pictures. I've since lost the phone, so I don't have the pictures anymore, but we came across Jim Broadbent's audition notes.
No.
And I just remember it saying, and Jim, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry, but it said, interesting looking, amazing actor.
Really?
Yeah, it was like, but I was just like, to write that on someone, interesting looking, but amazing. You know, but I mean, the guy is incredible. And there was a little sort of passport sized photo graph of him as a young man.
That's pretty cool.
But we knew that we had to give it away. We knew we had to give it back. We couldn't take that away. Yeah, we could have sold it for a lot of money, I'm sure.
If you'd seen him on Any Human Heart and pulled it out. Look what I've got. Were you a turtle as well, Jim?
Mockingjay, obviously, coming up. Have you actually finished work on that? Is it in stages? Do you have to go back for more? Because you've kind of got the hair.
I'm literally having 2 days off. And no, I definitely wasn't allowed to film that, unfortunately. But I'm still doing my biggest turtle impression. No, it's something that we're still very much in the fray of filming. I literally have 2 days off to come and promote this, and I go back tomorrow to continue filming. But it's going well, and what's great about it is, you know, being a big fan of the book and having like the image of how things end up in my head. Like now I know, you know, I've seen the final pictures of or final moments of like. Well, the final cut of so many things so far, and it's really exciting.
It's very coming excited. Together already, though.
Slightly. Well, we have one coming out in November, so it's like they're already having to cut it as they go, I think. It's quite a tough process.
So having to have got massively ripped for this movie to play Finnick, what are you allowed to have for lunch today? Does it have to be chicken?
No, I am safe, is what I'm trying to say. I'm safe. But I've got more filming, but I'm safe.
Okay.
Basically, my topless stuff is done. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Yeah.
So I don't have to worry about necessarily too much about what I eat.
Okay. So not a diet consisting entirely of cream cakes, but.
No, I'm still behaving myself for future. You know, like I'm kind of once a popped, I can't stop. You know, it's one of the things I don't want to completely indulge myself too much because I don't know what's around the corner. And at the end of the day, the producers could ask for something more and I go,
put the Krispy Kreme.
I'm definitely not the Finnick you cast right now.
We have a Norwich City connection with Hugh Jackman, who's been on the podcast talking about his affection, unusually for Norwich City. Now, you're from East Anglia.
I did not.
Unlike Hugh, who's not, I believe, from East Anglia.
No.
He is a Norwich fan. I don't know. I think he's even been to the ground. I wondered, you played Duncan Edwards in United, Manchester United player. Which Norwich City player would you want to play in a movie?
Well, what's so crazy is my favourite player there was Darren Eady, who is a big, big... Well, he played for Norwich and is still a hero, a legend there, but then went to Leicester and has since become like really involved with celebrity.co.uk, which is like this sort of auction site for Prince's Trust. And since he's got in touch with me, like, I mean, this guy was my hero. You know, I have photos of me and him, like me, like basically holding his hand, looking up to him, like lovingly. Like, I adored the guy. And he recently found me on Twitter, and I was already following him on Twitter, and he found me on Twitter and added me and was like, Sam. And we got in touch, and I now have his number. And like, I'm like, you know, this guy is a hero to me. So, despite the fact, you know, I think he was a better footballer than I probably ever will be, you know, he's a legend and I'd love to play him, I think.
Awesome.
I also have the connection so I can get to know him properly and portray him. Yeah, exactly.
Bingo.
Bingo.
Sam, make it happen. There you go. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nice guy.
It was lovely. Yes, very, very sweet.
One of these days you're going to say, no, they were horrible.
Yeah, well, you know, keep hoping. But yeah, he's still got his Hunger Games hair and everything at the moment. He's still got the Finnick tan and the Finnick highlights. Which I think he was a bit self-conscious of.
Was he busting out of his shirt?
Pretty much, yeah. But, you know, he made an effort to kind of squeeze himself into it.
I bet he did. Okay, now it's time for movie news. Lovely movie news. Helen, what do you have?
I have news that will bring either great joy or great trepidation to the hearts of sci-fi fans. The Battlestar Galactica film has been rumoured and talked about for quite some time. They've now got a new writer aboard, so it may be moving again. So Transcendence writer Jack Paglen has been hired by Universal to start working on a new story for the film. This does not appear to be anything to do with the genius Ronald D. Moore Battlestar Galactica series. This is going back to first principles of the show, the sort of 1978 version where humans were battling the Cylons while also looking for planet Earth. They were kind of on the run from the Cylons and looking for Earth. Ronald Moore's take on it was utter genius, and you know, frankly, anybody who dares attempt it will, you know, have to live up to something very, very good indeed. Mm. However, they're going to try anyway, so good luck with that.
We're ever optimistic here.
I am trying to be optimistic. I'm well aware that there are potential criticisms of the show's later seasons and the fact that it was, you know, it all got a bit confusing there at the end. But as long as there are characters like Starbuck and Six in there, and you know, I'm kind of happy.
I'm going to stick with the star theme,
sure.
Sci-fi theme with Star Wars. Every day we seem to be getting a little bit more information, and the newest information we have is that Peter Mayhew seems to be coming back for the role of Chewbacca. He is 69 at this point, but he did say that he is due to be filming this month, so there is speculation that Chewbacca is returning. Obviously, he was in Revenge of the Sith very briefly and to not much effect, but it might be good to see him back. An old grey Chewie, maybe some grey hair in there. I don't know. Yeah. It could work.
But, you know, Wookiees have longer lifespans than
that's true.
Creatures.
That's so true. And we saw the whole family in the holiday special as well. So
we
they
did.
Could get a look in.
We did. Poor old Lumpy. I just hope they don't kill him.
What?
I saw someone tweet the other day, Mr. Biggs from Antical News, who went, "Now we're probably going to see Chewbacca die." And
no.
I hope not. Chewbacca's my favourite character in Star Wars. I just hope they don't do it. I mean, I've got the Chewbacca dressing gown, the Chewbacca bag, the Chewbacca underpants. The Chewbacca smell. I've been working on that for ages. But
it's really coming along then.
Do you like it?
Yeah, really.
Walking carpet?
Yeah.
It's good. Walking carpet by Givenchy. I don't know. I just don't want it to happen. I don't want anyone to die ever. If you could work on that, scientists, if you're listening, while also bringing back people, if you could just make it so no one dies, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I think that's fine.
Fine.
I think that's fair. Yeah, but it's interesting.
Mm. Do we want to talk about this mooted Goonies 2 idea? Some guy called Richard Donner may have mentioned...
What's he ever done?
I know. May have mentioned that he has been considering... This is all so many italics and inverted commas around this. A sequel to The Goonies. Now, we don't have any more details than that. And that isn't really a detail. But how do we feel?
We need Nick Desemlian to react.
Certainly. Let's. I'll patch him in.
I mean, maybe it'd be good. There was a suggestion that the original Goonies would be the parents of a new generation of Goonies. Mm. It's not necessarily doomed to failure if something like that were to happen. It
True.
Can be done well.
Star Trek: The Next Generation, Goonies: The Next Generation.
Yeah. I don't know.
Again, you know, it works.
Does the Goonies brand still have cachet in today's for the youth of today? Do they understand what Goonies is? And more to the point, when you go back, I mean, I think we all probably grew up, Ben probably didn't, Ben grew up with movies like Transformers 3.
Parts of the Caribbean 3 as well.
Parts of the Caribbean and Stranger Tides, which I think is
all the threes,
your favourite.
Basically. Yeah.
But, you know, we grew up with the Goonies and we loved the Goonies when we were, you know,
in a certain age.
And now, you go back and you look at it again, it's a bit rubbish.
I thought it was a bit rubbish.
At the time, I loved it. I had the novelization. I watched it at least twice. It was really, really good. But I don't know. A sequel might. I don't think it's going to happen for one thing. B, I don't think they should do it. And C, if they do it, I'm going to go back in my Chewbacca thing and I say they should absolutely kill one of them.
No.
Not maybe kill.
Not
but someone. Someone should be dead off screen.
Okay, fine. Maybe.
You know.
Never say die, Chris. Come on.
Well, statistically, the law of averages would suggest in a group that large, with a 30-year gap between them, that at some point one of them would have died.
Who would you kill off?
Mouth.
Well, okay. I mean, actually, I'm not going to argue with that one because I don't care that much about the character. But, I mean, listen, the way Lord and Miller have kind of reinvigorated and breathed new life into various franchises of late, and also things that clearly shouldn't be adapted, like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs or Lego, and turn them into movies. In the same way, if you get somebody with a little bit of, you know, pizzazz to write the screenplay and really kind of think outside the box, or the treasure chest, if you will, you could end up with something kind of cool.
Speaking
you know.
Of Lord Miller, it has emerged that Ghostbusters 3 won't be helmed by them. They were in talks, but they have backed out of that particular fire station. So there you go. You know, Ollie Richards was very enthusiastic about it, and I called it. They weren't going to do it.
I think it's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing they're not doing it.
What if they're doing Goonies too?
Shut your mouth. That would be amazing. Anyway, my one thing that I wanted to talk about was A Truman Show, which I love unreservedly. I think it's fantastic. 1998 came out. That's a movie I've watched at least twice. No, it really is good. And obviously it starred Jim Carrey and really was so prescient about what came after it. It was, you know, years ahead, streets ahead it was. But now Paramount, as part of an ongoing push to take more properties onto telly, you know, a lot of people are doing this. Warner Bros. Was doing a lot with Arrow and stuff like that, with their DC Comic Universe and Vertigo and all sorts. But Paramount are trying to do a similar thing, and they've chosen The Truman Show. So obviously irony all round, but I can get it. I feel like now wouldn't have been the time to really capitalise on it. I feel not that it isn't still part of the zeitgeist. I think people know the concept of The Truman Show, but I think it would have been a better thing to do maybe when the Big Brother bubble hadn't popped.
It could be really interesting, though, because here's what always got me about the film. The ending is kind of portrayed as a happy ending, that he gets out. But what kind of life is that guy going to have? And actually, if it were me, I mean, you could maybe have a first series in the show to establish everything, maybe. But I think what would be far more interesting is what happens to that guy next. What happens when he leaves this incredibly controlled, beautiful, you know, serene world and enters the real world? And also, it's a real world where everyone knows his face, everyone knows his name, everyone knows every detail of his life. And I mean, in the show, it was weird. People were showing us clapping and cheering when he left the show. And I think if people had been obsessively watching this guy, you know, daily for his entire lifetime, there would actually be shock and horror and loss on their part that they had lost this thing that they were very attached to. And I think there'd be anger against him when he got out. And I think there would be sort of, there'd be some really, really interesting stuff to explore there. So maybe you need a first season where he's in the show and then you go and do that. But definitely, I wouldn't keep him in the show for more than one season.
I think you'd see a lot of time with him and a psychotherapist. It'd be like The Sopranos, but yeah, you're right, he'd be messed up.
There'd be lawsuits as well, slavery maybe. I mean, there could be all sorts of interesting things to kind of explore with it.
Anyway, look, let's see how it goes, but just to be aware of it, we'll obviously give you as much news as we get when we get it, but you know, that's on the cards.
Paramount haven't confirmed actually whether it is The Truman Show, though. It could be an actual Truman Show that they're
playing. Yeah, people have presumed it's a type of Big Brother thing. I really hope they don't go down that road.
Yeah.
Because obviously then the forest will catch on fire and you'll have to turn around because there's a nuclear thing and, you know, it's not a road you go down.
Just a couple of other things very quickly. Roland Emmerich is gearing up to shoot Stonewall, and he seems to have got a lead in the shape of Jeremy Irvine. So that will be interesting. That's obviously the story of the Stonewall riots outside the Stonewall Inn in 1969, 1967.
One of those years.
Which was a landmark moment in the gay rights movement, because it was a kind of a pushback by the gay community against the cops that had been harassing them.
Yeah. And very interesting, because it's obviously a more personal film for Roland Emmerich. He told me about it last year, I think, and he said it may happen for Independence Day 2, and clearly it is going to happen for Independence Day 2. It's just interesting to see a director whose movies have been rather impersonal going for something that's close to his heart.
I think actually his movie's been weirdly personal, but always just on an enormous scale.
True. Yeah.
This is a much, much smaller and more intimate story, and I think that will be really interesting to see what he does with it. So yeah, that's kind of it's kind of exciting actually. I'm a bit of an Emmerich apologist, as you know. So
I can't imagine he'll be blowing anything up in this movie.
Well, perhaps the prejudices of the day, Chris.
Yeah. Take that, prejudices. All right. So what else do we have? The Martian?
There's a little bit of news about Drew Goddard. He has officially been confirmed for Sinister Six, the Spider-Man villain spin-off thing. So he is off a movie he was planning on doing called The Martian. But there is not all bad news for The Martian, because there are rumours that Matt Damon is interested in starring. Now, that's probably not going to be confirmed until they have a confirmed director, because one imagines he won't want to sign on sight unseen, as it were. But where one person leaves, another one may enter.
All right, so that is it for the old movie news section. Now it's time for our second interview, and we're delighted to welcome a podcast regular, which is no mean feat given that he's based in Jakarta and it's quite tricky to get to our pod booth. He's also a man who may well just be the best action director on the planet right now. He's Gareth Evans, of course, the Welsh director who made an astonishing splash 2 years ago with The Raid and now follows it up this week with The Raid 2, a more sprawling, plotty but no less brutal affair. He came in last week to talk to, well, me. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined in the pod booth by the director of The Raid and The Raid 2, Gareth Evans. Hello, sir. You all right?
Good to see you, sir. Good to be back.
Good to be back. How are you feeling? This is your last interview on the UK leg of this tour. Is this?
Yeah, so you should be really enthusiastic.
Yeah, you'd be like, what's the question you've been asked most?
How did a Welshman end up in Indonesia making martial arts movies?
Are you still getting that?
I'm going to fucking tattoo it on my chest. I need to have it done.
You should have like a storybook laminate it and hand it out. So people are still asking that.
Yeah, I mean, an interesting way is like this. When I was out in Japan doing promo for the first film, I've been asked that so many times, and because they were always going through like an interpreter, right? And so I was like, you know, messing around, joking around with the interpreter towards the end, and I said, okay, this is the last interview now. If somebody asks me that, I'm not going to say a word. I'm just going to look at you and you can answer it automatically. And she was like, oh no, you can't do that, because it completely contravenes against the whole, like, you know, Japanese polite society and that.
Yeah.
So she was bricking them, and then the very first question was, how did a Welshman end up in Indonesia making martial arts films? And I gave her a look which for her lasted like an eternity, but for me was like about a split second before I went, so anyway, how I ended up in Indonesia was this, blah 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 blah.
Have you embellished it over the years? Have you changed the story?
No, I keep that one the same. The one I embellish when people say, like, how did you meet Iko? So I've started adding little things like, oh yeah, I was prowling Craigslist to find an Indonesian boy. then...
But that's true, right? Yeah.
Well, partly, yeah. Well, he hounded me, really, to be honest.
The last time you guys were over here for The Raid, Iko was still talking about maybe going back to his job as a... He was a phone technician or a phone engineer?
Yeah, he was a delivery guy for phone companies. Delivery guy, yeah. He would like take documents back and forth between offices and branches and things.
Mm. And clearly he didn't go back to that.
No. Thank God.
Was that as a direct result? Did you lean on him in a way to tell him? Because you seem to be in very much... You've become not only a ball-busting, literally, brother to him, but a mentor as well.
He's like my little brother, really. Like, and it's one of those things, I mean, like, you know, any kind of, like, brotherly relationship, like, knowing that I have an older brother myself, is that idea of, you know, you want to look out for each other and you want to make sure that everyone's okay, that he's on the up and up. And so, it's been a good relationship where we've managed to keep both of our egos in check by hitting each other in the balls every now and then.
When did that start?
My theory is that he started it first, because I don't think me and Matt would have been the ones to start that off. And Matt being my DOP, I'm pretty sure he kind of like took a sort of sneaky swipe at Matt once when we were shooting Maranto, and so since then gloves are off, literally.
Amazing. But but in terms, you said you keep each other's feet in the ground.
Yeah.
Has that been tricky? Because, you know, after The Raid. And after this movie as well. I mean, for God's sake, I introduced you last night as the best action director on the planet at a Q&A.
Yeah.
So when people are saying things like that, what does that do to you?
I
mean,
I just cringe. I just shrink in myself, because it's like, for me, I'm naturally pessimistic with things like that. So it's like, you know, for me, all of the sort of like responses right now are great. But for me, it's like it's all like a preface for that real big fall. You know, that's when it's going to kick in. I don't know. It's one of those things where I've wanted to do this stuff for a long time. I wanted to make films since I was a kid. Mm. And so as a result of that, being able to do it, and in the way that I've been able to do it, like, it's such a freaky sort of set of circumstances, being over there making films and in a genre that's not really accustomed to, you know, white folk. It's like, you know, it's it never loses its appeal. Like, I always feel like every single day that we're on set, it's, you know, and I know it sounds cliche to say it, but it's a fucking privilege. I can't believe I get to call this work sometimes. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. But how, in a way, your style, how did your style evolve? Because most action directors these days, or most action movies, especially the ones that come out of Hollywood, they still go for that very choppy,
action where you can, you know, they cut away an awful lot and you could tell the actors, it's not really the actors doing it, it's a stuntman. How's your style, which is very, very clean, and you know where you are geographically at all times? How does that evolve?
Initially, I mean, it came from that thing of, you know, watching like the great films like, you know, The Wild Bunch and, you know, Hard Boiled and The Killer. Watching all those movies and like, getting a sense of clarity in terms of the action scenes and, you know, looking at them and analysing them and trying to figure out what it is that still works about them. Because that finishing, the final scene of The Wild Bunch, it's like 40, 45 years old right now. And it still holds up. It's still great. And so for me, like, they must be doing something right. And, you know, I got tired of watching, you know, fast cut edits in action movies. You know, you watch a movie where there's an edit now, even in drama, like sometimes an edit every 2 seconds or 3 seconds, and your eyes can't rest, and it's exhausting to watch. So for me then, it was like, it was a combination of, you know, going back and watching those classic films, trying to analyze them, trying to figure out what it was that worked. But then at the same time, I think a lot of it stems from that thing of working with the choreography team from the beginning, because then I'm able to see then, okay, what's their thought process going into each one of those moves? Why are they doing a punch here? Why are they doing a kick here? What's the approach in order for them to do that throw or that lock? And then once I can kind of see that in sort of like in minute detail, I'm not looking at it from a presentation point of view anymore, where I'm just trying to figure out like, okay, well, here's my master and here's my coverage. I'm looking for those shots which are going to tell the audience exactly what the choreography is. And, you know, by guiding their eyes to it, it becomes more clear then. That you guys can follow it more and appreciate it the same way that I get to appreciate it the first time I work with them. I don't feel like we did anything that innovative with it. Just took a step back. And, you know, that's just my personal... It's always been my personal preference anyway.
It's interesting as well how much you shy away from slow-mo.
Yeah, I only ever use slow-mo usually for, like, a dramatic purpose. Like, we never use it for to showcase a shot, never to show off, like, a movement that the guys do. Because, like, our whole remit was that when we were doing the first movie, Miranda, it was to kind of reclaim CLAT. It was to kind of figure out a way to kind of, you know, take it away from what it was back then, which is terrible TV, horrible version of, like, you know, CLAT guys in robes jumping up into the sky, turning into a jaguar, shitting out a fireball. And
that sounds great.
Yeah, I know.
So I'm on board. Sign me up.
With beers on a Friday night, it's fucking awesome. But yeah, but the problem was is that it kind of had this effect where when we were doing the first film and we were trying to pitch it to people, man, they were like laughing us out the door. They'd ridiculed CLAT because it just wasn't respected at all. And then all of a sudden, now we're in a position where, you know, there's about another 2 or 3, 4 action films to be made in Indonesia now, and they're all about martial arts or gunplay in some way. So yeah, there's potential for it to expand more now.
There's an amazing nightclub showdown. I won't say who's involved necessarily, but it's phenomenal. Just the sheer amount of people attacking one guy and the way you use the location. Can you talk about that? Because the raid was so intense and so claustrophobic.
Yeah, well, for that one, it was one of those things where we designed a fight first and we had an idea of what the fight should be, what the choreography should be. For that one, we improvised a lot. Like, we would shift choreography around, we would shift, like, you know, shots around and the order and the structure of things around. Because when we got to that location, suddenly we see all these, like, tiered balconies everywhere. And they just looked beautiful. It looked really nice. And I was like, you know, we'd be wasting our entire time here if we didn't make use of that location. So then suddenly we are adding stuff on set, last minute, changing things around, making full use of the whole architecture of it. And it was, you know, it was important. Like, so when you cut to that scene, one of the first shots before the guys come out and fight is a massive wide shot where we show the entire layout of the nightclub. So we get to see it full, empty, no people there. So then all of a sudden you know now, okay, so down here is where the bar is, down here is where the dance floor is, over here is the exit points, and over here there's another opposite tiered area. And so we're able to make use of that. Then we're able to get into the thick of the fight. Then people already know where everything is. And so, yeah, it kind of boosts the feel of the scene and the intensity of it. But also, the audience has a geographical knowledge of it.
You're nearly done with the UK junket, and that's nearly it. So you're nearly done with the raid 2. Are you thinking about raid 3?
I have ideas. Yeah. And we talked about this last night in the Q&A, right?
We did, yeah.
So you're going to get my
standard answer.
No, it's not. I'll try and give you a little bit more, yeah. We'll make it special this time. There'll be no hand gestures, no sort of like, you know, standard sort of ways of saying it. It kind of go back to Back to the Future. So, you know, back to
Wild West.
Yeah. Doc is going to shoot the shit out of Ico. Actually, you know what? Have you seen the YouTube clip?
No.
No. Okay. Okay. So, all right. I'm going to say a joke first. If you laugh and you get it, okay, and you've seen it.
All right.
So, we're going to have a scene basically in the Raid 3 where Ram is going to be stood there and his kid is going to be in the background of the shot. And then suddenly the kid's just going to point at his penis.
What?
Okay. You don't get
it. I haven't seen it.
I'll explain it now because some of your viewers might get it. If you watch Back to the Future 3 and you go on YouTube.
Yes, yes, yes.
There's a scene at the train, right?
At the end, yes.
With Doc and his kids. And the kids, yes, and the kid points just at his fucking penis.
Yeah.
It's the bizarrest thing I've ever seen.
With a big shit-eating grin on his face.
I know. Like, it's amazing.
I've just pointed at my penis in the, at the
end. It's so strange. Like, I want to know what went on in that kid's life. Why he did that on on the set of, like, a huge film. It's like, I can't. Like, it's like, what's the thinking behind it?
It's amazing.
It's incredible.
So, if that's the one that made it in, what didn't make it in?
I know. And what I want to know is, like, there must have been a point where they noticed it, because, like, you know, when you're editing, you watch things like 1,000 times, and then eventually you start paying attention to the people in the background. Yeah. Like we did that in the prison riot. Like, there'd be shots in the prison riot where, when you're shooting it, it's just like, okay, are the foreground guys good? Great. Okay, good, done. And then you walk through it and you see the background guys, and then the background guys, suddenly you're like, 10 views later, you're like, oh fuck, look at these guys in the background, look what they're doing. And like, you know, it's terrible, it's so bad. So sometimes we do digital zooms to reframe and fix.
Oh, sweet.
The toilet fight, we had this one guy who was so bad in the background of a shot that we digitally painted him out and replaced him with a wall in the floor. Yeah, so
poor bastard.
No, fuck him. He cost me a shit ton of VFX money. But yeah, fair so enough, there you go. So we're not on the standard answer yet, but I'll jump in now. Now I can do my standard part.
Oh my God.
So the Raid 3 is, it's that idea of like, okay, so the thing with Back to the Future was that thing of, it was always continuous. It was always feeling like the story kept going. Mm. Didn't matter how far apart those films were, you felt like you were watching one continuous story. But what I want to do for the Raid 3 to make it slightly different is that thing of jumping back in time to this, like one of the scenes with one of the gangs when they make a decision on something. And we follow the fallout from that, so we branch off to follow their story for a bit.
Mm. So you got a time frame?
I have a time frame on this one. Maybe 2 years, 3 years down the line, I'm going to make that one. But what I haven't told anyone yet, and I'm telling you now, is that I'm going to make that one back-to-back with another martial arts action film I want to do with Ico in Indonesia as well. So we're going to shoot 2 films back-to-back that year. And then I'm going to spend an entire year and a half on post-production. Jeez. Where I get to sleep normal hours.
Amazing. Amazing. Because I imagine you haven't had a break for, what, 2-3 years, something like that?
Yeah, I think the last time I had a decent night's sleep, I think it was probably just after the World Cup. I think so. Nah, it was all good.
Luckily, there's another one coming up. You can get plenty
of sleep. Exactly, yeah.
Plenty of sleep for that one. I just want to dwell for it. But the Raid 3, will that involve Ico or will it not? If you're shooting something back to back with Ico, if you don't want to say, honestly, don't say.
Yeah, I'm not going to say for that.
Don't worry.
Surprises.
No, let's keep that one under the old hat for the time being. But so, what is next for you then? Before those two epics,
in the immediate future, I'm doing like producing for that film I mentioned earlier with Timo, and that one's, we should be finishing that one by November this year. But then next year, then I'm at the moment in early development on 2 projects. One is with Universal to do in the UK, and that one's a sort of it's a true story about an MMA fighter and the biggest cash robbery in UK history. And then after that, which by the way is an incredible story. By the way, it's like, it's just insane. The stuff that went on is crazy. So I'm really excited about that one. And then other than that, then I also have another project in development that's with MRC for me to do out in the US. And that's like a sort of like an American gangster action film that I'm writing myself called Blister. And for that one, I told Matt about the idea I had for that shot in the Raid 2 with the camera going out of the car and going into the other car. He called me a maniac. And then recently I told him my ideas for Blister, for this one shot idea that I have where, like, I think he might now be considering my friendship with him. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, is it involved? Is it long? Is it both? Is it mayhem?
It's probably the most ambitious thing we'll have done.
Okay.
So we'll see how it goes.
That's saying something. And so apart from weeping when Everton don't make the Champions League. Do you know with do you have a time frame for those? Do you know when which one might go first, those two?
Right now it's hard to tell because it's one of those things where they're both in different stages in development, and it's like whichever one goes first, really. Like, I'm passionate about both, so yeah. So if they are listening, don't worry.
Grant, well, listen, Gareth, man, I'll let you go.
Cheers, man. Thanks again for having me.
Cheers. Thank you.
Gareth Evans there, lovely, lovely chap, and I wish him all the best, despite being an Evertonian. Okay, so let's start with The Raid 2, which was called The Raid 2, but Rand Dalbert is now just called The Raid 2. What do we make of this one, Helen?
Well, this one, I mean, the Raid, for those who have seen it, you won't need reminding, was basically a sort of a very contained affair. It was a SWAT team fighting their way up a building to get to the guy they were after on the top floor. This one is less contained. It's much more kind of sprawling, much more epic, much, much larger in its ambition. So we start literally a couple of hours after the end of the last film, and we kind of follow on from there. New characters are introduced, and our hero, Ecowise Rama, is sent undercover. Basically, he's prevailed upon to go undercover into a really brutal prison to befriend the son of a crime boss and make himself indispensable to him. But this is like no short term assignment. We're talking like a 2-year kind of deal here in this prison, trying to establish his cover identity and then get in with his crime family when he gets out, which is obviously no easy thing for a family man with a young child. And it goes on from there, and it turns out this crime family have competition for their territory. So there's various kind of political shenanigans. There's almost a godfatheriness about quite a lot of the kind of behind the scenes stuff. And then there's the action, which is, oh my god, action. This is like nothing you've seen, certainly since The Raid, and possibly not even there. There are some bits of unparalleled brutality, and then other bits of, you know, absolutely astonishing human athleticism and ability, and, you know, gorgeous, gorgeous shooting of really, really awful things sometimes. Mm. So it is absolutely brutal. It is absolutely gory at times. There's a girl with two hammers who uses the claw ends as well as the hammer ends.
Hammer girl?
Hammer, well, yes, but, mm-hmm. you know, there is some very inventive use of sports equipment. It is some seriously, seriously violent stuff, but it is never less than brilliantly done.
Agreed. I mean, I wasn't set this one, so I won't talk too much about it. Having said that, sometimes you go on a set and you come away with an idea of what a film's going to be, and then the film disappoints. In this case, it didn't. I saw some fight stuff going on when I was in Jakarta last year that just looked amazing, and the finished product turned out to be even more amazing. The action sequences in this movie are astonishing. I don't call Gareth Evans the best action director on the planet right now lightly, when there are people knocking around like called James Cameron and Edgar Wright and John Woo and whatnot, but I've seen very, very few directors, including the likes of Peckinpah in this, who stage action with such clarity. It's astonishing. You never lose sight of where the protagonists and the antagonists are in a sequence. You never lose sight of what's happening. He doesn't go for that. Everything's beautifully, classically shot. We discussed it a little bit in the interview about his style and how he manages to get such clarity of image. But it is amazing, the sheer amount of mayhem and the visceral nature and the impact of many of these sequences, all of which are I think, almost a level above what happens in The Raid in terms of the drama of the scene and in terms of the choreography of the scenes. It's just mind-blowing, and I cannot wait to see what this guy does, you know, with a major, major budget, if he ever decides to go down that route. It's astonishing. There are elements of, we gave it 4 stars in Empire. I think our reviewer and a few people felt that the drama doesn't maybe work quite as well as the action sequences. It's very intricate. It's very complex. There are a lot of characters. Ecowise as Rama does get shoved to the sidelines, which is a deliberate decision on Gareth Evans' part, but maybe doesn't work entirely well because, you know, he does become very much in the periphery of action for a while. And you don't really get a sense that his job is corrupting him in any way, which is something that I think there is a theme that they were trying for, that Gareth was trying for. It doesn't quite entirely work, but the action here, especially the last 40 minutes, which is just a brutal, brutal onslaught, has some of the best fight sequences you will ever see.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that the widening out the scope does inevitably lead to a slight lack of focus in terms of, you know, the last one was so tightly plotted and so tightly wound. When you widen the scope out in the way that they have, and they've widened it hugely, you do lose a little bit of that focus and that kind of drive at times in the middle of the section. But my God, the ending. And, you know, it's not all just, we should say, it's not all just martial arts fighting.
No,
there's an incredible car chase in there. There's some astonishing gun work. There's just everything. The action start to finish is brilliant.
It's true. But the drama scenes, for what they are, show to me that there is an amazing filmmaker besides an action filmmaker in here. In the opening shot, it's just the meticulously, everything's meticulously framed, beautifully paced, there's real ambition here.
Yeah.
Like, he may not entirely achieve everything he's trying to set out in terms of the drama, in terms of the ambition, but kudos to him for trying. And I think the action sequences are just absolutely astonishing. The oof, ooh, oh my God count in this movie is higher than it was in The Raid, and that is saying something. So 4 stars for The Raid 2. And if you love The Raid, you will love this movie. It's as simple as that. Okay, so let's move on now to Calvary, the second film to team writer director John Michael McDonagh and star Brendan Gleeson, following the brilliant The Guard, which we gave 5 stars to. This is no less Irish in that movie, but much more serious. It follows Gleeson's priest as he tries to figure out which member of a small town parish has just threatened to kill him.
This is bloody brilliant, frankly. Kind of the opposite of The Guard in some ways. That was an incredibly cynical character surrounded by less cynical people, generally quite nice people. This one is a really, really good man, totally surrounded by horrible people. Everybody hates him. Everyone basically holds this priest responsible for essentially everything that the church, Catholic Church, has done wrong in the past, forever, which in fairness is quite a long list of things. And he's basically sort of struggling to do the best he can and do the best he can for his parishioners and try and, you know, for example, mediate in a marital dispute. He's trying to help people out with their problems. He's trying to take confession. He is also a literal father in the sense that he has a daughter. He entered the priesthood late in life, so he's trying to be a good father to Kelly Riley's character when she comes to visit. But he's being pulled every which way. And of course, hanging over his head from the very first moments of the film is the fact that someone has told him that they're going to kill him in a week's time. He knows who it is, but we don't. So for the audience, it's kind of a who's going to do it, rather than a whodunit. The film basically gives us no end of suspect because everyone is kind of vile to him, really. But having said that, you know, this is a McDonagh movie, and as with all of both John McDonagh's movies and his brother Martin's, there's humour in there as well as the drama and as well as the kind of the darkness. And it is a very, very funny film at times as well. It's also worth seeing for Brendan Gleeson's magnificent stripy beard. Genuinely, like this kind of incredible salt and ginger confection. Ah, it's wonderful. He also, like, he wears his surplice, his kind of robes the whole way through, kind of setting him apart a little bit more. You know, visually, you never forget for a second this guy is a priest. And that's kind of an interesting choice to make. Priests don't generally do that nowadays.
That would be an ecumenical matter.
It would, actually.
Five stars then to Calvary.
Yes.
Amazing.
It's wonderful.
Amazing film. The cracking second film then from these two. Can't wait to see that they're going to do another one.
They are. It's called The Lame Shall Enter First. And
yes,
we won't say the name of what they're calling the trilogy. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to
give things away.
It might, although John McDonagh argues it's not a spoiler. So I'm going to put that. I've got an interview of his. It's going to be up on the site by the time you listen to this.
All right.
I'll put it in spoiler text, but I will put it in the interview. So if you're interested, have a look at that.
The Guardian had an interview with Brendan Gleeson this week, and they
printed it.
They printed it. But you know, hey ho.
Is the trilogy called like Snog, Marry, Kill or something?
The trilogy is called it's called the This Is What the End Is.
Essentially, yeah.
Amazing.
Essentially,
the all go home in a giant big balloon.
Yeah,
exactly.
Trilogy, yeah.
Yeah. So okay, 5 stars in for Calvary, and then let's move on to the next one. We're probing deeply, or deeply-ish, which is The Quiet Ones, the Hammer horror film with Sam Claflin and Jared Harris, as a group of paranormal investigators investigating paranormal stuff. I can't sum it up much more succinctly than that.
So is it the British Ghostbusters?
It's British Ghostbusters with a little bit of paranormal activity, The Last Exorcism, and other things like that.
Well, it's not quite. It's a bunch of medical research.
Is it you again?
It is me again.
Bloody
yeah.
hell.
No one else saw anything this week.
All right, okay.
Basically, a bunch of medical researchers in 1970s Oxford University, led by Jared Harris's professor slash almost cult leader. He's got a real
Is that his name? Professor slash almost cult leader?
Yes.
He is ominous.
It is ominous, yeah. Foreshadowing.
So he basically is determined that he thinks there is a way to trace people's mental disturbances and cure them through sort of electrical impulses and envisioning what's going on around their head. And he has this very disturbed girl who he thinks this treatment can cure. And he's all fired up. He's like, if we can cure this, we can cure everybody's mental illnesses and everybody will be well and
Hooray!
Happy and everything is wonderful. Of course, what he doesn't consider is the possibility that maybe her disturbance is in fact paranormal.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and it totes is. So when they go off to a house in the countryside, so it's basically Sam Claflin plays a cameraman, Brian, recruited from the town. They've got a couple of students there as sort of, you know, nurses slash orderlies slash whatever. They'll go off to this big scary house in the country, and of course big scary things start to happen to everyone. And the question is, you know, there's an interesting question over this patient at the whole heart of it, you know, is she doing stuff? Is she malignant? Is she a good person who's just afflicted? What's going on?
Hammer's got a really good record on this, because this is a Hammer horror film of their new revival, and they've done quite surprisingly well, really. They did well, Let Me In, I personally hate, but it sort of did quite well. And
but the Woman in Black was amazing.
Station was good, and Woman in Black did really, really well. So, I mean, is this kind of continuing their return to form?
It's okay. I would say, rather than a storming success. I think The Woman in Black is much more successful in terms of scares. This one felt a little bit chopped up to me. It felt like there were some scenes that they'd shot and then cut out. And everything didn't quite always hang together as a result. The pacing's a little funny. I think you get, you know, quite relatively few scares, and then suddenly everything goes really scary towards the end. And it's a little bit kind of, it's a little bit patchy for me, but good performances, beautifully shot, looks really, really cool, kind of 70s kind of a feel to it, which is a bit more interesting than the usual find footage kind of movie. And it's an interesting idea. It's like, oh, we're treating this as a mental illness, but is it really kind of a thing? So we give it 3 stars, and that feels about right to me.
Okay, fantastic. So also out this week is the Norwegian thriller Pioneer, which stars Axel Hennie, last seen covering himself in poo in Headhunters, and that gets 3 stars. Also, there's The Last Days on Mars, which is a fairly ambitious but ultimately disappointing The Thing Meets 28 Days Later kind of movie on Mars, starring Liev Schreiber, the spellcheck nemesis, and Olivia Williams, and that gets 2 stars, which is just about right. There's also B.E. Bandele's adaptation of Half of a Yellow Sun, which features great performances from Joseph Moll, Chiwetel Ejiofor, his first movie post 12 Years a Slave, although he shot it before 12 Years a Slave, and Tandy Newton. We gave that 2 stars. Sadly, it's very, very pretty, well acted, but not much more to it beyond that. And then there's also The Strange Colour of Your Body's Tears, which sounds like a Phil Desemnia special. It is a brilliant, a mysterious and disorienting blend of giallo violence, cinematic experimentation, a Lynchian psycho horror. Not my words, but the words of Kimothy Newman. And we gave that 4 stars. So there you go. A hell of a week at the old multiplex, or indeed arthouse cinema of your choice. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be talking Amazing Spider-Man 2 and much, much more. There's also an Amazing Spider-Man 2 spoiler podcast coming up with producers Avi Arad, Matt Tomac, who are due into this booth any second now, and director Mark Webb, which is very, very exciting. Until then, it is goodbye from, what's your name again? Helen.
Hi.
Helen.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from you. It's goodbye from Ali.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from Ben. How was it?
It was good. It was my first time. You were very gentle. I enjoyed it.
Gentle Ben. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to resurrect Barbara Windsor. It doesn't matter that she's not dead. Just go with it. See you next week. Bye.